Well, this was the vehicle, I'm sure. It's the only new thing that happened within striking distance of the teachings of Jesus. It was two generations later.
You're out.
Right. John was still alive. The Apostle John was still alive at Ephesus when the Mahayana was coming into being. That gives you a feel for the generation span. He's an old man. In Confucius, you're taught social order, ethical relationships, the veneration of the past. Confucius stabilized Chinese society at the cost of formalizing it and stagnating it. The first emperor of the reunited Chinese states, one Shi Huang Tai, and that one's spelled in a jillion different ways, sometimes Wang Tai. He was the Qin Emperor of China and gave the name China to China. His was a dynasty that lasted only a generation and a half. It was just prior to 200 AD, and Confucius would be 6th century, or the 500s. He tried to destroy all the works of Confucius because he wanted China to be progressive. But they were restored under the Han Dynasty, which started about 200 AD. It was the Han Dynasty which ruled in China in the days of Jesus. Confucianism has stabilized China at the cost of progress, because if you're going to venerate past practice, then you're not going to change. It produces a very stable set of ethics and a very clear-cut code of morality and obligation. It stresses the family. If you borrow money, your whole family is behind that loan and is liable for it unless it's paid. Let's see, we've covered everything in the East, starting with India, except Lao Tzu, who is my favorite character. If I could reopen the canon of the Bible, I would add the Tao Te Ching to it. I know it should be pronounced Tao Te Ching, but nobody understands what you're talking about. And it should be called Lao Tzu. But then again, in Warsaw should be called Vaishavi, and I still like Warsaw. Lao Tzu was supposedly a contemporary of Confucius, and he was the keeper of the archives at a place called Luoyang, up in what's now not too far from Pekin, along the Yellow River in the north of China. This was the seat of the Chu emperors, and the Chu emperors at that time had about as much authority in China as the Holy Roman Empire did about, let's say, 1600 AD. China was feudal, just as Europe was feudal at this time. Lao Tzu was more than a librarian. He was a teacher, and he taught. And according to legend, he was observed by the keeper of one of the gates in the Great Wall of China, which was even then partly built. And this captain of the gate saw the old philosopher, because that's what Lao Tzu means. It is old philosopher. He saw him walking through this gate, and he said, "Say, old philosopher, what do you think you're doing?" And Lao Tzu replied, "I'm going through into the country beyond the wall." Well, he said, "But there's no civilization out there." Lao Tzu said, "Yes, I understand this. That's why I'm going there. I'm going to spend the rest of my life in meditation." And the captain says, "But you can't do this. What's going to happen with your classes down at Luoyang? We need you. Our young people need your teaching. You cannot leave us." And the old philosopher said, "But I've spent my life in teaching and in giving people what I have. And I think these few remaining years should be mine to spend in quiet meditation." And the captain said, "Well," he said, "you've got a point there. Let me think." And he looked up and he said, "I'll make a deal with you. I will let you through the gate if you will sit down and write out your teachings so that posterity will still have them. And I like to, it's this one of the sweetest legends I know. I like to picture the old Chinese, and he must have been quite old, squatting down with his paintbrushes, his inks, his paper, and in beautiful strokes, drawing the characters which spell out the Tao Te Ching. I have found the Tao Te Ching the most intriguing writing I've ever encountered. If you want to taste the flavor of it, you must not stop with one translation, because these Chinese characters lend themselves to many interpretations. At one time, I was almost tempted to study Chinese, simply to experience the joy of reading this in the original. But that's stupid. So I contented myself with buying every translation of the Tao Te Ching that I could buy. I once owned 7 translations of the Tao Te Ching, and each one was fascinating to read. And somehow, in reading the 7, I felt I was getting nearer the meaning of the original. Tao Te Ching is sometimes translated as the simple way. It starts out very much as the papers start out, when it says, the Tao that can be named is not the true Tao. Or, the God which can be named is not the true God. And the very first section in the blue book says, God has never revealed himself by name. And they list all the names which we apply to him. In this first chapter of the Tao Te Ching, it says, unity begets duality, duality begets triunity, and triunity is the ancestor of the 10,000 things. The Rancho book paraphrases that statement. It's in the Tao Te Ching where it likens spirit values to water, because they bless everything and harm nothing. And like water, they always seek the lowest places for their ministry. Isn't that beautiful? It's in the Tao Te Ching that he points out the virtue of emptiness, because it can be filled. It's in the Tao Te Ching that he teaches humility and the avoidance of contentions. This is one of the most peace-promoting documents I've ever read, just as the Upanishads are some of the most stimulating intellectual speculations I've ever read. You know, these were written by the wise men of old. And while they're not in our tradition, these men were just as wise as the prophets who are in our tradition. I don't know of any other person I can quite compare Lao Tzu to. He has a unique flavor. It was one of his disciples, I think. No, this is one of the disciples. Was this? No, I was a disciple of Confucius. Mofu Menicus is his anglicized or Latinized name. who got the idea of relativity? He said, one night I dreamt I was a white butterfly flitting in the forest, and I experienced all the sensations of a beautiful white butterfly. And then I awakened, and ever since I pondered, am I a man who once dreamt he was a butterfly, or am I a butterfly now dreaming he is a man? Isn't that charming? Yes, yes. If you want a sample, just one non-Christian religion, pick Lao Tzu, because the scripture is very short. It doesn't take very long to read the Tao Te Ching. And if you're lucky enough to get an unstuffy translation, you may be intrigued to get a better one. And if you got a good one, maybe you'll be intrigued to get a still better one. Yes?
Could you tell us the one you think's best?
No, I don't have these at my fingertips. but simply go down to a good bookstore and ask them for different translations of the Tao Te Ching. If you wanted to have some fun, why don't each one of you get a different one? Yes, and then swap books.
I've got one. It's a paperback from Brentano, but I can't remember the author.
There's a big book called The Religions of the World, which we'll give it to
you. The World Bible, I've got
The World Bible, yes. You'll find it in there.
That. But I don't know.
But then get other translations, too.
That is.
I think it's in the Tao Te Ching that he writes so beautifully of death. The bow sheath is dropped, the arrows clatter upon the ground, and in the confusion, the soul begins the long flight home. I love that book. Well, we can forsake the East now. Do you have any questions to ask?
Did you tell about the time in which it was written? I mean about what?
Sixth century.
Sixth.
Buddha, Mahavira, Confucius, Laozi are all children of the 6th century when Machiavelli Melchizedek stirred things up. This is the century in which Greece responded with the birth of philosophy, not religion. Yes?
Bill, there's one sentence in the Urantia book that tells about the greatest teachers of the world.
Yes.
And that they have those.
Yes.
With Philo. Philo was the Greek one.
Yes. Philo was much later.
Yes.
So,
but he's listed as one of the great teachers of the world.
Philo was the man who reconciled Jewish theology and Greek philosophy and laid the foundation for the later reconciliation of Christian teaching and Greek philosophy. Let's come back east. Let's go back to the Vedas again. And let's see some of these boys pouring down into Persia with their fire gods and their thunder gods and their Soma and whatnot. And also in the 6th century B.C., a religious teacher arose in Persia by the name of Zarathustra or Zoroaster. Thus spake Zarathustra. And he produced a religion, which is the only religion, to perpetuate any phase of the 7 master spirits here on earth. He taught a religion which is very important to us because if you do not understand Zoroastrianism, you cannot understand all of Christianity. Because Zoroastrianism had a considerable influence on Christianity. First, because it influenced Judaism during the Babylonian captivity. Secondly, it influenced Christianity directly. Third, its daughter religion, Mithraism, was for a long time one of Christianity's principal competitors. The concept of Satan comes from Zoroastrianism. When it says in the Bible that God stirred up David to number the people, that passage was written before the Jews came under Persian influence. In a parallel passage, and I'm referring to the two passages in Kings and Chronicles, where it says, "And Satan stirred up David to number the people," a very bad thing. This is post-Zoroastrian in its authorship, because prior to their encounter with Zoroastrianism, the Jews reckoned that Yahweh was responsible for evil as well as for good. The whole story of the Caligastian Rebellion, the Lucifer Rebellion, is at the foundation of Zoroastrianism. And the religion which Zoroaster preached was this kind of a religion. In eternity, there is one God and his 7 expressions, and the name of this God is Ahura Mazda. The word Mazda is associated in our minds with light, and Ahura Mazda is the God of light. In eternity, Ahura Mazda is alone and victorious. But in time, he contends on equal terms with Ahriman, the god of darkness, or the lord of darkness. In time, this is an equal contention. In eternity, the light will triumph. If you will read the scriptures of Zoroastrianism concerning the day of judgment, you will be shocked because they will seem so familiar to you. And of course you know which came first, because these things go back to the 6th century BC. In the Zoroastrianism presents a morally challenging religion. In Zoroastrianism, you are confronted with a challenge. There are two armies, and you've got to choose sides. And as you choose, so do you eventually become. Zoroastrianism is a militant religion. The Zoroastrians were no more afraid to fight than were the Mohammedans. Zoroastrianism persisted until it was destroyed by the Mohammedan invasion of Persia, which would be about, well, the Hegira was 622, so add a few years, say along about 650 AD. Between the revival of the Sasanian Empire, that's the Neo-Persian Empire, let's go back. The Bactrians, way back here, were cut off from the Western Greeks by the Parthians, who came down about 200 BC. And the Parthians once reached the Mediterranean Sea. They were semi-barbaric horsemen. There were people living in the days of Jesus who could have remembered the great Parthian invasion that smashed all the way to the water. It was the Parthians that fought the Romans to a standstill. It was the Parthians that poured molten gold into the mouth of Crassus, one of the triumvirate, when he tried to do some conquering. These Parthians lasted until about 200 AD, when the Persians revolted and established the Neo-Persian Empire, the Second Persian Empire, sometimes called the Sasanian Empire. S-A-S-I-N-I-A-N. You see, the Second Persian Empire separated from the first by all the era of Alexander, his successors, and the Parthians. And then they reestablished it. This period is a period in which you have nationalistic religions contending. When Western Rome went down, Eastern Rome did not. And it gradually metamorphosed into what we call the Byzantine Empire. And this is the chrysalis of the Greek Orthodox Church. And the Greek Orthodox Church under the Byzantines was a department of the state. The Ecumenical Patriarch in Constantinople was in essence the secretary of religion, reporting to the Basileus, the emperor, in Constantinople. So here you have a nationalist religion in Byzantium, you have a nationalist religion in the Persian kingdom, and you have a real fight between these two religions, each of whom supported and promoted the heresies of the others. If you were a Nestorian Christian, you were welcomed in Persia because you were anti-Greek Orthodox. But if you were Greek Orthodox, you had a hard time in Persia. We've touched upon the Mohammedan religion. The Mohammedan religion presents a clear-cut monotheism, a very clear picture of a highly anthropomorphic god. And if you're going to have a monotheism, you better have anthropomorphism too. Because as the papers point out, if you've got a solitary god, sooner or later, philosophy will abstract his personal qualities and you will end up with an impersonal god. So as long as the Quran has to portray a solitary deity, it's probably just as well that he's an anthropomorphic deity. I think the exact dimensions of Allah are given in the Quran. He is a man, but he's a great big guy. He's pretty big. The Quran has a good deal to say about ethical practices, dietary practices, the position of woman in life. And you girls will be fascinated with the fact that you're much better off under Paul than you are under Muhammad. In Paul, you keep quiet in the church. Under Muhammad, you don't even have souls. You don't go to heaven because it would be embarrassing. Because the Muhammadan paradise is an eternally lost weekend. It is a sensuous version of Valhalla. You know, in Valhalla, you wind up there and you fight all day, and if you're killed, they bring you back to life and you feast all night, and the next day you fight all day.
No working. I know they're drinking.
Oh, lots of drinking in heaven.
In heaven?
Oh, yes, that's why you don't drink on earth.
Oh, the Mohammedans.
That's right.
I know they don't drink on earth.
That's right. They booze it up forevermore. And each guy has, let's see, it's a quantity. Is it one dozen or two dozen? Dark-eyed houris. And this is Allah's idea of a perfect gal. And you have your tribe, and you, well, let nature take its course. You simply have at having fun. And you won't be bothered by your wife looking over your shoulder because she won't make it because she doesn't have a soul. The Muhammadan religion, like communism, is a religion of a people and a state. There's no dualism in communism. It's very much like Muhammadanism in this respect. All of your loyalty is in one basket. The state, the church, the true believer, the infidel, and so on. The Muhammadans conquered. It was one of the darndest things that ever happened when they erupted out of Arabia. And they were successful because just prior to the conquest, the Byzantines and the Persians had engaged in a life and death struggle which utterly exhausted both kingdoms. At one time, the Persian army was encamped on the Asiatic shore of the Sea of Marmora. That's on the Asiatic side of the straits. The Avars had overrun the Balkans and were right smack up against the triple walls of Constantinople. And Heraclius, the emperor, considered transferring his court to Carthage, which had been reconquered for the Byzantines by Belisarius some 200 years earlier. And it was the ecumenical patriarch that loaned him, the treasures of the church loaned him now, and he put an army together, and instead of arguing about Constantinople, he embarked his army and struck for the heart of the Persian Empire and started raising hell and burning everything. And by the time the Byzantines finally drove the Persians back, everybody was worn out. It was into this power vacuum that the Muhammadans erupted. The Muhammadan religion is a religion for men, not for women. It's a very masculine religion. It's a fighting religion. It teaches that one's surest passport to paradise is to die killing the infidel. At the same time, this Muhammadan religion exhibits tolerance. If you are one of the people of a book, like the Quran, you can pay a head tax and you will be tolerated. Jews and Christians were recognized as people of a book. Later on, Zoroastrians came in under that same category. The story of the Christian relation to the Jewish people is one of the most shameful stories in recorded history. The story of the Muhammadan relations to the Jewish people is one of the brighter pictures in human history. When the Muhammadans entered Spain, the Jews were their allies because they had suffered much at the hands of the Visigothic Christian conquerors of Spain. Under the Muhammadan regime in Spain, a Jew became a prime minister of the Emirate of Cordoba. I don't know how the Muhammadans will take the Urantia book. It's going to be very interesting to see. I don't know how hungry they are. Yes?
When you say anyone with a book, like a Christian in the
Yes.
You mean because they have Bible?
Muhammad recognized Jesus as a prophet. Muhammad recognized all of the Jewish prophets as prophets, and himself as the last prophet. Jerusalem is a holy city in the Muhammadan religion, as well as in the Jewish and Christian religion. It's the third most holy city, ranking after Mecca and Medina. Mm-hmm.
Well, how could thinking Muhammad women get any comfort from this religion?
Well, thinking Muhammadan women haven't had much to think with for a long time. It's just recently, and in Turkey, let's say, a Muhammadan gal is raised with, she has some freedom, at about age 13, they begin stuffing her. If they can get her up above 200 pounds, she'll sell better in the marriage market. And she moves from seclusion in her father's home to seclusion in her husband's home, and from then on she deals with women and some merchants. She has no education. She doesn't read the Quran. She isn't going to object very much because this is all she knows. She never had a bathtub, so she doesn't know the joys of a bathtub. Now, what'll happen in a country like Turkey? Let's see. They've set up a secular government in Turkey, which is apart from the church.
They're still Muhammadans.
Oh, yes.
Well, I'm going to organize Muhammadan women. They would like this group.
Well, they're just breaking loose. For example, in Morocco, one of the princesses in Morocco is a westernized gal. And because she is princess so-and-so, she can get by with some things. And they're just now cracking this whole thing. Sure. Do we go into Judaism?
No.
You know that one, don't you?
Bill, okay.
Yes.
We need to tell you that he had to go on an errand.
Yes.
So you know.
Right. $5 and the $4. Do you want to go into Judaism?
Yeah.
I'm not going to cover the conventional side so much, but I'll try and give you some background that isn't quite so well known. I've forgotten my sequence of the prophets. I know Samuel comes first.
Did you give us a date? I'm sorry, I don't have this one.
Muhammadanism, 622, is the big date in Muhammadanism.
They're all in that 622.
This is afterwards.
622.
A.D.
Oh.
A.D.
Do another
thing. Right. Oh, there's one we ought to touch upon besides this. 622. If you will take 622 and subtract it from the current calendar date, you can then write AH after that date, and you've got the Muhammadan calendar. And AH means Anno Hegira, or the year of the Hegira. Make the subtraction.
622 from?
1959. What do you get? This is the year 1537 AH.
1337.
If you will add approximately 700 years to our current calendar, that would be 2659, would it be?
Yeah.
You now can put AU after that date. That is Anno Urbis, or the date from the founding of Rome. You see, the whole idea of A.D. didn't come into current usage for some five or six centuries after the time of Jesus. There was one other generally used time reckoning, and for that you should add about 300 years to the current calendar, and I've forgotten what you put after the date. But that is the Seleucid calendar, reckoning from the founding of the Seleucid dynasty in Babylon. You see how recent the concept AD, BC, has been used for only about the last 1,400 years. We should go back to Asia and touch upon one more religion. Up in this same area, where Mahayana Buddhism arose. A religion arose about 1500 AD. It represented the teachings of Nanak Shah, more properly known as Guru Nanak. Guru means teacher. He was the first of the great Sikh teachers. And that religion is written down in a book called the Granth Sahib. And the Sikhs are a little more reverent of the Granth Sahib than the Bible Belt Protestants are of the Holy Bible. They just barely miss worshiping the Granth Sahib. It's kind of icon-like, you know what I mean? If you want to read some good reading, read the Granth Sahib. This is a putting together of much that is good in Mohammedanism and Hinduism, with maybe some lingering traces of Buddhism there, for all I know. Granth Sahib. But get the Bible of the world. You got all of this stuff in one volume. I think Sikhism's in there. I'm pretty sure it is. It should be. You will get a potpourri, a sampling of all of these scriptures. This religion has given rise to an interesting community in India. When you say the word Sikh, you are talking about a people and a religion. You can't separate the two. Yes.
Are they not three people? I met one.
Yes, they are.
Yes. Arizona.
Yes. They're quite high grade people.
And they're listed in our blue book, aren't they?
Yes. They're just barely mentioned.
Yeah, in the West.
They're mentioned as having arisen contemporary with Protestant Christianity, and the word Protestant doesn't appear in this book. In the most delicate way, they point out that at about that time, the Christian religion had attained that degree of inelasticity which made further growth incompatible with unity. That's all they have to say about Protestantism in the whole book.
Yeah. This deep warm bracelet.
Mm-hmm. Right. He didn't cut his hair either, did he?
No.
He wore it tied up under his turban.
Yeah. He never took the turban off.
That's right. That's right. They never cut their hair. They're quite a race of fighting men. The British found this out. It took quite a little effort on England's part to conquer the Northwest Provinces.
Well, isn't this list? I can't find it. Along,
yes, it is.
Among the 10
I'll give it
powerful
to you.
religions
in
the world.
It's the last one.
I'll give it to you.
Yes. But among it's the 10 most powerful religions on this earth,
isn't it? No, it's the
10 modern religions.
Well, I'm surprised about that because I didn't think it was just very deep.
It's not powerful, it's the 10 major religions.
And it's the last to evolve, isn't it? They say that.
Paper 1011. Page. Gee, I wish we had 1011 papers.
Sikhism, the most recent.
In their discussion of Protestantism on the preceding page, they just cover the 15th century after Christ. This period witnessed two religious movements, the disruption of the unity of Christianity in the Occident and the synthesis of a new religion in the Orient. In Europe, institutionalized Christianity had attained that degree of inelasticity which rendered further growth incompatible with unity. In the Orient, the combined teachings of Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism were synthesized by Nanak and his followers into Sikhism, one of the most advanced religions of Asia. It isn't very big, though. The Sikhs are not a large community, but they're compact and they fight hard. Well, back to Judaism. Judaism carries the heaviest strain of Melchizedek's teachings, but Judaism is not an original religion. Judaism started out with Egyptian culture. Moses himself was half Egyptian. If you would like to trace out the Egyptian background of the Old Testament, there's only one book I know that has it, and that is The Dawn of Conscience by Breasted. The Dawn of Conscience is an examination of the evolution of moral concepts along the Nile. It's an awfully good book to read in connection with a section in these papers which discuss the Melchizedek teachings along the Nile. It's the only book I've found in which you can read much about Amenemope mentioned in the Blue Book. And Breasted points out where Amenemope's teachings from his Book of Wisdom had been repeated in the Old Testament, and how it explains some of the peculiar idiom of the Old Testament, which doesn't make good sense in a pastoral country, but makes excellent sense in the Nile Valley. Let's see. A good example of an Egyptian moral maxim is from the sayings of Tahotep, who was Grand Vizier of Egypt, and I think is on the flyleaf of this book. Established is the man who walketh in righteousness and whose actions are governed by its ways.
That's wonderful.
Yes. As you read, reading Breasted would be fun for you. It's fascinating because it's the history of Egypt in terms of morality, not just wars and things, you know.
Is Breasted still alive?
No, but he wrote the book when he was.
Oh.
Pardon me, Ruth.
Yeah.
That was such a sweet one across the plate, I couldn't resist swinging at it.
Who's the publisher yet?
What?
The publisher.
No, I don't. I don't, but they'll have it listed.
You know, we have a book in Cairo, did you know?
Good. Wonderful.
It went in 1956. Play on Egyptian.
I think one of the most fascinating sections in the whole Blue Book is the secular history of the Jewish people, in which they clean up the Old Testament and tell you what really happened. And if you haven't read it, in heaven's name, read it against the background of the Old Testament. I'm not going to repeat what's in there because that's pretty easy to understand. That's the story of a courageous people.
Yes. Profane history?
The profane history, the secular history of the Jews. The Jewish religion is a synthesis of Melchizedek's teachings as reflected in some of the teachings of Akhenaten, the teachings of Amenemope, perhaps the teachings of Akhban, whom we don't know anything about. He's mentioned in the Blue Book as a prophet in Egypt. They speak of four prophets as having risen along the Nile. Akhban, they murdered. Amenemope, they ignored. Akhenaten, they disavowed. And Moses, they drove out. Moses was the fourth prophet along the Nile. I think the Jewish religion is the only religion which had a fortuitous succession of teachers. I think the Old Testament is fascinating because you can see the God concept evolving if you look for it and are not beguiled by the fact that the same name is used. These papers speak of two religions which have evolved enormously, Judaism and Mahayana Buddhism. Starting from something, they became something quite different. The Yahweh concept starts out as the spirit demon of the fulminating volcano of Sinai. This is the kind of a demon who could give, you might say, underhanded advice to his chosen people. He is for his people, and he doesn't care about any other people. When they're getting ready to flee Egypt, he advises them, to glom on to all the Egyptian possessions which they can get their hands on. This concept of a God for us and not the aliens apparently is a necessary part of the evolution of religion. Example, when Akhenaten, a century or so prior to Moses, when he taught that Aton was an international god, it took the heart out of the Egyptian army fighting in Syria. If Aton is as much for these Hittites as he is for us, we're whipped. It subtracted from men's courage. Akhenaten's teaching of monotheism helped collapse the Asiatic possessions of Egypt. The Jews had an additional reason to believe in a future, because their God was not alone, but he was greatest among the gods, and he was for them. Moses started with henotheism, which is the exaltation of one God among the many, and apparently is a necessary step in the evolution of monotheism out of polytheism. The Jewish religion was greatly influenced by the Babylonian captivity. In the Babylonian captivity, they received a full exposure to Zoroastrianism. They also received a terrible shock to their nationalism. And it was in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley that the great ideological struggle was fought between the two forces of Judaism, and the bad guys won. It was the struggle between nationalism and internationalism. The priesthood were espousing the nationalist cause. Second Isaiah's writings portray the internationalist concept of Yahweh. This is the apex of the evolution of the God concept among the Hebrews. And if you'll read part 4 of the Urantia book carefully, you will discover that Jesus has virtually quoted everything that 2nd Isaiah said, which means he endorses it. This is a big God concept. This nationalist victory was accomplished by the rewriting of the Old Testament. They took the book of the doings of the kings of Judah and the book of the doings of the kings of Israel and a few other sources, and they rewrote this Old Testament as we now have it. They miraculized the Old Testament. This helped get the people back to Judea. It helped rebuild Jerusalem. It was a powerful nationalistic stimulus. And it was so powerful that when they later on lost their sovereignty and regained it and lost it again, it made it impossible for them to accept Jesus, because he was not the Messiah. He was not coming in the nationalist pattern. They were looking for another David, as they had written David up. As near as I can see, David was a bit of a stinker. That Bathsheba episode is just plain shameful, you know. Nationalism in the Jewish religion finally splintered under Titus. There were too many Romans. It's like the Finns fighting the Russians. I'll bet you these Jews gave the Romans the fight of their life, but the Romans had too many legions. And they dispersed the Jewish people. They completed their dispersion all over the known world. The later history of the Jewish people in Europe is a rather horrible thing to read. And if you've got a good, strong stomach, you'll find it in Will Durant's Story of Civilization in the volume, The Age of Faith. In Will Durant's Age of Faith, I find the only account that's handy of what happened to the Jews in Europe. And as you read this story, you are going to grow very ashamed of Christians. Did you know that the first Crusaders, when they came along the Rhine, decided it would be a pretty good idea to take care of these heretics, and that thousands of Jews were killed, that synagogues were broken into, and when they broke in, they found that the men had killed all the women and then had killed each other to avoid forcible conversion. There was one real sporting German baron that gave him a castle as a sporting chance, and the Crusaders did not take that castle. They fought him off. It's a shameful story, and it represents the greatest problem that the Blue Book has in dealing with Jewish people today. If you'd like to read something else, you might read Shalamash's Introduction to the Nazarene, in which he tells how, as a little boy in Warsaw, he first met Christ. He was a very small boy, and he left the ghetto to go across town. It was on the Sabbath. He was dressed up in his Sabbath best. And some Polish boys, good Christian boys, much larger than he was, got a hold of him. They roughed him up, they tore his clothes, they bloodied his nose until he said, "We crucified Christ." This is how Shalamash met Christ for the first time.
What's the name of the book? Then?
The Nazarene.
Why should Will Durant have dug into the history of the Jews?
Will Durant said that in the Middle Ages, the Age of Faith, there were, let's see, there were four cultures interacting. There was Western Christendom, Eastern Christendom in Byzantium, Mohammedanism, and the Jews.
Why doesn't the book say anything about Mohammedanism?
It does. It says very little. I'll give you the cite.
Oh.
It's the Melchizedek teachings in the Levant. It's the Melchizedek teachings in the Levant. Last chapter. Uh, 1050. The Salem teachings in Arabia. Today, I find this among Jewish people. My grandparents were Orthodox. My parents were confused. I have no religion. This is pretty much the pattern. I pick it up in our attempted measurement of religious motivation. Many of them score quite low. And I make this prediction. As Judaism loses its hold on the Jewish people will cease to be Jews. This is the cement that's held them together many, many generations. I remember many, many years ago when I was personnel officer in a bank. This is a long time ago. And there used to be a little guy by the name of Sammy Krug, who was one of the homeliest men I've ever seen in my life. He was greasy and he smelled of sweat. And he ran a second-hand tire retread shop, and he discounted paper with us. And I liked Sammy. I mean, he wouldn't be my bosom companion for a fishing trip, but Sammy was a good customer. And this was during the Depression, and the fact that Sammy smelt of sweat meant that there was one less person on his payroll, which meant he had one more chance to make the grade. And I can recall, I used to chat with him. He had a Viennese accent you could cut with a broadsword. And this was the days when Hitler was arising. One time he came over where I sat by the rail, and he said, in his inimitable accent, "Mr. Sadler," he says, "you know I like you. You're not like these other stuffed shirts around here that won't give a guy a tumble just because he doesn't come in here well-dressed. These are my officer colleagues." Well, I said, "Sammy, what the dickens? Your money's as good as anybody else's. You do business here. Why shouldn't we be polite?" He said, "You know, you're a nice guy. Sometime," he said, "I'd like to take you to the temple. And I'd like you to hear some of the things that they talk about there. They're wonderful. We don't have a lot of this superstition business about God and things like that. We got some real live discussions about politics and sociology and economics." And I thought a minute and I said, "Sammy, did you ever stop and think that it's this superstition about God and things that's held your people together all through these years?" He says, "What do you mean?" I said, this is like the mortar that's held the bricks together, that's kept the Commonwealth of Israel going. Well, he says, what'll happen if we lose it? Well, I said, maybe you'll just kind of absorb into everybody else. And old Sammy looked at me thoughtfully for a minute. Then he said, well, when you read about what's going on in Germany today, I ask you, would that be so bad? I had no answer for that one.
I don't think it would.
No,
I think it's
excellent.
It's just like in.
I think the liberal Jew is a good prospect for the Urantia book if he didn't meet Christ as Solomash met Christ. The word Christ is a pretty dirty word. Oh, yeah, one religion left. You want to talk about it?
Sure. Which one?
Christianity. Christianity started out competing pretty hard with not the established religion of the Roman state, but with the mystery religions which had come into the Roman state and which the patrician Roman families abhorred. These were Oriental mysteries. Was it said the Orontes, or the river alongside of Antioch, now flows into the Tiber? The Romans never had much of a religion, any more than did the Greeks. The Romans had even less of a religion than the Greeks. Happy-go-lucky Zeus is hardly an object of worship. In the last analysis, Zeus remained a small-sized god. He never became a king-sized god because Zeus never became master of fate in Greek thinking. Zeus was just as subject to fate as was any man who walked on earth. I think this is the one thing that Zeus missed. If he could have only gotten on top of fate, he might have evolved just as Yahweh evolved. The mystery religions really competed with Christianity, and Christianity took on their coloration in making a mass appeal. The original Sabbath was Saturday. That's when Jesus worshiped. But Sunday, the day of the sun, was the holy day of Mithraism. And when they switched the worship from Saturday to Sunday, it felt better. You know what I mean? Everybody was happy about this. They took on much of the ritual. If you want to get a good book on this subject, get The Mystery Religions and Christianity by an Australian Presbyterian minister by the name of Angus, A-N-G-U-S. The Mystery Religions and Christianity. We think these mystery religions are pretty bad because, remember, the Christians wrote the story of the mystery religions. We don't read about the Mithraic martyrs that were slaughtered by the Christians, but they've been dug up where they were slaughtered kneeling at their pews. There was infighting on both sides.
What was the name of that author?
Angus. A-N-G-U-S. The Mystery Religions and Christianity. Christianity first articulated its organization into the patriarchs. There was the Patriarch of Alexandria. There was the Patriarch in Jerusalem. There was the Patriarch in Antioch. There was the Patriarch in Constantinople. There was the Patriarch in Rome.
Now those were early divisions of the Christian Church.
Yes. The concept of bishop is a successor of the apostles. And this bishop has received his powers by consecration from those who once were consecrated by someone of the 12 who were consecrated by Jesus. Right. Early in the evolution of Christendom, the bishops of the larger cities had more authority. Originally, there was no patriarch at Constantinople. Because originally there was no Constantinople until Constantine founded it. And then its bishop became a patriarch. And in a church meeting, an ecumenical council where they set up precedents, the bishop of Constantinople received second precedence in Christendom, ranking with and after the bishop of Rome. These bishops, the structure of the Christian church took form when the Roman state adopted it, and it patterned itself after the pattern of Roman political organization in the later empire. Rome was divided into provinces, each of which had a provincial capital. The church divided itself into dioceses along these lines. The capital of each province was a larger metropolis than the other cities, and the bishop residing in the provincial metropolis was known as a metropolitan. And the title metropolitan is equivalent to the title of archbishop. It was the original title for archbishop. Later on, as this metropolitan attempted to exercise authority over the bishops situated in his province or diocese. Originally, the metropolitan stood between the patriarchs and the bishops. Later on, that was broken down. This was the big fight between the papacy and the metropolitans in the West.
About what year?
We're getting, Ruth, into about 400 AD. Constantine would have been about 320. And this is about 400.
Augustine, about.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Maybe not. Yes. When did the Vandals get down there? Yeah. 400, 500. 476 is the so-called date of the fall of the Western Empire for an anchor date.
476?
476 AD.
I had 412.
No, you're a little early. In the West, this evolution of the church eventually resulted in the direct responsibility of all bishops to the Bishop of Rome. Another level grew up, a super metropolitan grew up, a primate. A primate is a bishop who presides when there is a national conclave. A metropolitan or archbishop is a bishop who presides when there is a provincial conclave. Eventually, all of these intermediate groups became authority which was purely auxiliary to the authority at Rome, so that all bishops reported directly to Rome. The Roman Church had a major battle on its hands for control of its own bishops. Every king wanted to control the bishops in his domain, and since these bishops held extensive feudal properties, each king and the emperor in Germany had an argument. If you were the Archbishop of Liege, you held extensive domains in fief from the emperor. And you were a lay lord as well as a spiritual lord. The whole struggle between appointment and investiture is a pretty shameful story of a fight between the emperors and the popes. Question, Ruth?
Yes. The Holy Roman Empire, I've never...
Understood this?
Understood that.
All
and
right.
This seems as if it might
it
clear it up for me.
All right. The empire went down in the West. It survived in the East until 1453. The empire idea still lived in men's minds. From 476 until 800, there was no emperor in the West. but the Caesars still sat, or the Augusti still sat in Constantinople. In 800 AD, the Pope crowned Charlemagne. He crowned him because he was the strongest guy in the West, and he had temporarily produced some order. He had come down and smacked, well, his daddy, Pepin the Short, came down and smacked the Lombards who were threatening the papacy, etc., and so on. This was the restoration of the imperial crown in the west of Europe. This crown, Charlemagne's empire was divided. The Franks always divided everything. Well, there was a kingdom of Toulouse at one time, and all manner of things. They split the empire three ways, roughly into the East Franks, the West Franks, and the Middle Franks. In the Middle Franks represented an impossible strip of territory running, starting in about where Holland is, and Belgium, and Luxembourg, and Alsace-Lorraine, and Switzerland, and the north of Italy, down to Rome. And this was the dominion of Lothar, hence the name Lotharingia, which we know today as Lorraine. Ever since, the East Franks and the West Franks have been battling for this middle strip. Much of the history of Europe is the war for the control of the Empire of Lothar. The crown, everybody didn't get crowned. It wasn't automatic. You had to go to Rome to get this crown. There was a period of lapse when there was no emperor in the West. And then, when the imperial idea was revived, this time it was revived among the East Franks, who are in process of becoming the Germans, as the West Franks are in process of becoming the French. And the crown, the East Germans operated this way. They elected their king. The East Germans had retained a tribal organization which was lost in Gaul. The Duke of the Barbarians was elected by the Bavarians. And eventually the great tribal dukes would elect a king of the Germans. Later on, this king of the Germans was wont to go to Rome, and when he was crowned, then he was emperor. He received his crown from the Pope. And this was a revival of the Roman Empire, the second revival of the Roman Empire in the West, called the Holy Roman Empire of the German people. It was Roman because the crown had been revived, it was holy because it came from the Pope, and it was the Roman Empire of the German people. You see, people thought empire, people thought emperor. This was a restoration of that which had been lost. It was an attempt to go back and reproduce what the Romans once had. If the king of the Germans was not crowned, he could not call himself emperor. He was king of the Germans. If he was emperor and wanted to assure the succession of his son, he had his son elected by the electors, and the title there used was King of the Romans. King of the Romans is crown prince designate, who has already been elected. With the death of his father, he would become king of the Germans. When crowned with the Pope, he would become emperor.
Was it optional?
He didn't get it automatically. He had to go to Rome and get the crown.
Yeah, but I mean, did some of them not go to Rome?
Yes, that's right. Sometimes they didn't have time. And succession was not automatic. It was not hereditary.
Yeah.
And not until the Habsburgs got there did it virtually become hereditary. Yes.
Didn't the French have that Roman prince too?
No, they didn't. They had the Dauphin later on. In France,
how come Napoleon had a king of Rome? Oh, that was different, yeah.
In the days of Napoleon witnessed the end of the Holy Roman Empire, and I believe the date is 1806. And that's when the last Holy Roman Emperor abdicated that title and created, simply out of thin air, created a title, Emperor of Austria. The last Holy Roman Empire became the first Emperor of Austria. Napoleon tried to revive the empire idea. He crowned himself emperor, and he called his son king of the Romans in imitation of this old German custom. No, in Germany, until the Habsburgs, the succession was by election. And election was by the great princes, including some of the archbishops, a couple of them. There were about, I think, 8 or 9 electors. And this is what it means when you read in history, the Elector of Brandenburg. He was one of those who elected the emperor. The Elector of Saxony. In the general settlement of the debris created by Napoleon, these electors adopted the titles kings. So that as we see them, at the beginning of World War I in 1914, we have a king of Saxony, a king of Bavaria, and so forth.
Luther took advantage, or saved, wasn't he, by some of this squabble.
Sure.
Among the princes.
The Germans were very hostile. The Germans were very hostile to the Italians, because the Italians controlled the church. All kings, all political sovereigns were jealous of the Pope because they had taxes being raised in their own country that went to Rome.
Yeah.
And the thing that enabled Luther to win was each one of these princes, dukes, electors, in Bohemia they became kings, he had a chance to get a hold of the church in his territory. Lutheranism, I think, represents a retrogression in the evolution of religion. While the Roman Church claims sovereignty over nations, the Lutheran Church accepts political sovereignty over the church. If one of them has to win, I'd rather the church would win than the state.
Why, Bill? He wouldn't want that now.
You can have Hitler under Lutheranism. Much easier than you could under Roman Catholicism. Mm-hmm. The church acts as a check on Franco. Yeah. But the fundamental dogma of the Lutheran church is you support the civil authority, whatever it is. The church could criticize Franco, but the Lutheran church, as the church, could not criticize any government it found itself under.
Lutheranism developed the appetite that made the Germans follow Hitler, according
that's
to
Huxley. That's a real moot point. Let's go back. This is how Protestantism got started. The church dominated everything. It stuck its nose into all corners of life. Nationalism fought it. The princes were against it. And the thing got to be so cynical that each prince had a right to decide what religion was going to operate in his area in Germany. And so some were Protestants and some were Catholics, and that's the way it went. And he had the army behind him. Let's go back to when the Bishop of Rome wasn't so big. The thing I think that, well, let's go back to the turning point. I always like to examine these junctures in history. Where do we miss the boat? Maybe we can learn. At one time, the whole idea of the election of the Pope got out of hand. The Pope was originally elected by the Roman people. At the time of imperial supremacy, when the empire got going before the papacy did, the emperor virtually appointed the Pope. Later on, a group of ecclesiastical authorities were constituted the electors of the Pope. And since these were the first men of the church, they received the title cardinal, which means first. And it carries the civil rank of prince. A cardinal is a prince of the Roman Catholic Church. As the Pope is the emperor of emperors, he wears 3 crowns. A king wears 1. The emperor wore a double crown, so the Pope adopted a triple crown. The cardinals, some cardinals broke off. At one point, there were 2 popes. There was a pope in France and there was a pope in Rome. For a time, and everybody was excommunicating everybody. No matter which side you were on, the other side was going to excommunicate you. One time there were 3 popes. What?
What century? Straighten
me out. We're along about in 1200 now.
Oh, I haven't been 8.
There was a time when there were 6 popes at the same time. 2 abdicated, I think. I was reading about
that. They finally got this thing got so bad that they called an ecumenical council of the church. Up until this time, the one authority that could override a pope was the bishops in session. And this means also the abbots, the archbishops, the primates, and everything. When all of the church authority assembled, it constituted the supreme legislative body of Christendom. And they cleaned things up. As I recall, this may have been the Council of Trent. They fired all the popes, and they elected one. Now, here is where I believe we could have made the grade without Protestantism, because I regard Protestantism as a major disaster. It really is. Even the name is all wrong. It's a negative name. And consider what's happened to Protestantism. Did they stop splintering? No. We're still splintering. This world needs a new church, just about like it needs a hole in the head. If they could have maintained legislative supremacy in Christendom, I think the Christian church could have evolved, and it could have avoided the rigidity which it later developed. But they didn't. When this council dissolved itself, the Pope went right back to his old-fashioned ways, and since the cardinals never loused things up again, and we never got more than one pope, the legislature was never again in position to challenge the executive authority in the Roman Catholic Church. And pretty soon the Turks were pounding at the gates of Vienna, and the Pope could act as the rallier of Christendom, which he did rather ineffectually. And it's been that way ever since. In the meantime, we're stuck with how many different creeds and sects in Christendom?
Somewhere, the Urantia book is quite kind to, I thought.
You find it speaks well of Christianity, and it can speak harshly to Christianity.
Yeah.
Bill, in the year 400, when Attila came down, and the Pope was supposed to stop him,
mm-hmm.
What was he just out of supplies and tired, or what?
No, the early popes carried a good deal of weight. Everything had collapsed in the West except papal authority, and many of these popes came from patrician Roman families. I mean, they were very able-bodied guys, like Ambrose in Milan. Ambrose was quite a big shot in the civil government, and they elected him Archbishop of Milan over his protest. And I think, let's see, he was ordained a deacon on Monday and something else on every day until he could make Archbishop the next Sunday. He had to go through the hierarchy, but he did it in 1 week. The church attracted the best men in these days. Everything was crumbling. Everything was going to pieces. In these earliest days, the best justice was available in the court of a bishop, not in a corrupt Roman civil court. We're way back now to the Romans, about 400, 500 AD. Some of the very finest brains in Europe were attracted to the early church, and they built it. It was the most vital thing that carried on after the collapse of ancient civilization, and it carried the seeds of civilization with it. We ought to go back and touch on the Greek Orthodox Church. Oh, there were lots of heresies. There was Arianism. They believed that Jesus was lower than the Father. They were non-Trinitarian. There was Gnosticism.
Bill,
yes.
How do you spell that word, Arianism?
The same way as you spell Arian.
Oh,
in Mr. Hitler's. Yeah. Arianism.
Yes.